Okay, so how's it going? See, just a reminder, if you realize that you do have a problem set to by tomorrow morning's I don't actually know when we'll pick those things up out of the box, but I sort of tell you I do plan to just post the solutions tomorrow too. I think it's really important that follow up on the solutions and go through each problem thinking about what you were thinking, what you did, what I was thinking, or what the solution set says on these different things, and sort of come to closure on it. Sometimes you may feel pretty confident that you did it right and or did something that works, and it may actually really work. And the solution set, it may be done, and it may also work, and it might be done in a different way. It's worth going and checking. You know, it may be that you are doing it in sort of a conventional way, and the problems, the solutions are as well, in which case, just do a quick check, make sure that you're on track. It's completely your responsibility to do that, right? And it's a very important way to learn. I would say the same thing about the exam solutions. When I hand this back, whether you do well or not, you should go through and make sure you understand the solutions and that you're happy with them. Along the way, checking the grading, which is a reason to do it, but also it's really part of the learning experience. My laptop's giving me a little bit of trouble today. It's sort of old. I probably need to sort of rebuild the entire system. Oh my God, that's not good. It's writing about a centimeter above where I'm putting the pen. Oh, this is not going to be good. Not good at all. That's a new one. When it gets in a flaky mode, very often I'll put the pen here and it'll write over here. And then basically I kill and restart and kill and restart. And eventually it comes to where it behaves. Typical computer crap, right? For no reason at all, it sort of all of a sudden decides to behave. Sometimes I have to reboot. I'm sort of trying to avoid doing that because that takes a little while. But I may not have a choice, so sorry. Let me try something simpler. A little bit better. Okay, so let's see if we can make do with that. All right, so just a reminder of what we were doing in class last time, because I rushed a little as the boards were at the door. So if you remember, we were doing this example problem where we had a charge distribution running from minus L to L. It's an even charge distribution, so we describe it with a constant lambda in coulombs per meter. And I ask, what is the electric field at a point P in space up above the line segment, above the midpoint at a distance Z up above? So that's the problem. And we looked at the symmetry in the problem. And in the symmetry, whenever you do these sorts of problems, I mean, it's always good to sort of look at a differential piece of the charge and think about what it's doing, and then think about other differential pieces of charge and see if it tells you anything about the symmetry of the problem that maybe tells you what to do. In this case, if we consider this dq, all right, so that's a lambda dx, little tiny bit here. Think of that as just a charge. That will, let's call it positive. So it will create an electric field in space at this point, which is along this pink dE. It's a differential E because it is a differential charge. It is also a vector, which I didn't put.
So that's what you get from this little d cubed. And if you look at this thing, because of the symmetry of the problem and the fact that you're above the midpoint, for any dq over here, you'll have a d cubed and equidistance over here, which has the same charge. So that d cubed will give you a dE, say, in this direction. And if you just look at this vector and that vector, you'll see that they have left-right components that will cancel, and up-down components that add. And if I sort of define this as a theta, then this component, or that component, is going to be E times cosine theta. So I can take the general expression for the electric field at point P, K dQ times R hat over R. We're now integrating our position R across all of this, and dQ is then the charge that we're integrating. So we rewrite that. I take advantage of the symmetry. I integrate from 0 to L. I multiply by 2 because I know each dQ is going to give me just that component. And it's the same on one side as it is on the other. I have K lambda. That gives me the charge times dx. So dQ becomes lambda dx, lambda being the charge per unit length. R hat really is the direction. I know from the symmetry of this it has to be in Z, and I project out the component along Z by putting in cosine theta. And then we have R squared. Because I want to integrate on this distribution along this X direction, and Z basically is fixed, I'd like to put this integral in terms of Z and X. You might imagine trying to do it in terms of theta. I think that might have been doable, but probably gets you into a bit of trouble. I haven't even bothered with it. But let's put it in terms of X and Z in this case. And cosine theta, then putting it in terms of X and Z, becomes Z over X squared plus Z squared. X squared plus Z squared is the magnitude of R. And then this adjacent side, if that's theta, is just Z. So this piece right here is cosine theta, and R in terms of X and Z is going to be X squared plus Z squared. Okay? So this then becomes the integral that you have to do. And so you do it, or you look it up and do it. It doesn't matter to me where you get it, but when you do that integral, this is the answer that we looked at at the end of class last time. And where I really wanted to start this class is to discuss, okay, this is what you got. I don't know about you, but when I look at it, I don't have a good intuitive feel about it. Right? I wasn't born knowing what the field of a line segment is. So I have to think my way through this. And there are a couple of ways which you should... can use the check, and you really should just get in the habit of always doing these things, all right? Because they're the best tools you have to know whether you're on track. The first one is dimensional analysis. As you well know, in physics, a number is a number, but it's just a number unless it's something else. And if it's that something else, it has to come with units, right? It's representing something else. So units are really important in this business. On the left-hand side, we have an electric field. It has units of newtons per coulomb. Remember, electric field is force per unit charge, newtons per coulomb. So that's what we have on the left-hand side. The right-hand side better be equal to that, or we know we have a problem. So the first thing, if we look at this, let's look at the units for K. I don't remember units of K. The only way I can get that is to say F is equal to KQ squared over R squared, which I happen to remember. Okay. Maybe you know the units of K. I don't care how you do it, but make sure you've got a way of doing it right. For me, I have a brain that's a bit of a colander thing. Some things it latches onto, and a lot of it just goes right through. So I'm going to show you what I latch onto, but there's no magic to it, okay? For me, I always have to go back to this because that's what I can remember. And so having done that, the units on K have to be newtons times meter squared divided by coulomb squared. So there it is. I put it here. Then I have an L, which has units of meters. I have lambda, which is coulombs per meter. It's a charge per unit length. So that's the top, the bottom. I have meters here, square root. That gives me a total of meters times meters is meters squared. That meters cancels that one. This Coulomb cancels one of those. This meter squared cancels both of those. So we have newtons per Coulomb. So the dimensional analysis checks out. All right. Just get into the habit of doing that. So again, here's our formula. The other thing that you can do that's very powerful is to try to invent limiting cases where you just know what the answer should be. In this case, there are two different types that actually offer themselves. One is, suppose you have this little line segment, and now we let z become really large. So you're now very, very far away. Okay? If you're very, very far away, that line segment looks like a point. If you have a point charge, you know what the field is, right? It goes as kq squared over kq over r squared. So that's what we should expect. So if we allow z to go large here, then this term, z, becomes dominant. So you basically have z squared to the 1 half, which is z. So the bottom becomes 1 over z squared, and the top is a constant, where L lambda, 2L lambda is Q. So you end up with KQ here. So KQ over Z squared is exactly what you would expect as you go very far away. The other limiting case, which may not be as obvious to you yet because we haven't really done it much or haven't done it yet to calculate it, but there turns out to be an easy way to calculate what the field is for an infinite line current. And we'll do it soon. But if we allow L to become large, then we have a different system. It's not just a finite segment. It's now an infinite line current. If L is large, then you have, in the limit, you have a divergence of infinity over infinity. So you have to use L'Hopital's rule. When you take that limit, L go to infinity of this quantity, you get, take the derivative on the top and the bottom. You end up with 2k lambda over z. In the z-hat direction. And again, I promise you we will derive it, and you'll find that that is the field around the infinite line charge. So sometimes you can only do limiting cases around things that are obvious, things you know, or can calculate easily. But you should always go looking for those. Sometimes they're easy to find, and sometimes not so easy to find. Okay, any questions on that? Okay, so we've done one example of calculating electric field outside a simple charge distribution. Let's do another one. Imagine that we have a sphere of charge. And let's say that we have a charge, a total charge Q, we think of it as positive charge, which is distributed evenly in a sphere of radius R0. Okay? And let us consider a point here outside of the sphere, which is on the z-axis.
What is the electric field at that point, P? All right, so
in essence, this is exactly the same problem we did. We just have a different charge distribution.
So what we know is that the field at point P is equal to the integral over the charge distribution of K times rho, which is the charge per unit volume, dV r hat over r squared. All right, so what are some of these things? Well,
I've given you the fact that rho is a constant because I've said the charge is evenly distributed. So rho we can figure out.
Rho is equal to this total charge Q divided by the volume of the sphere.
If you don't remember things like volumes of spheres, area, surface of a sphere, area of a circle, circumference of a circle, cross-section of a cylinder, volume of a cylinder, area of a cylinder, fix it today. Because you're going to use it all the time. And it's pretty simple stuff. Okay, and we'll think our way through it. But the volume of a sphere is 4/3 pi r cubed. Those are, you will only really need to know those geometries, but you will really need to know those geometries. And if you screw it up on an exam and you put the volume of a cylinder when it's a sphere, I promise you the TAs will laugh while they take away points. Okay? They will have a good time with that. So don't let them do that at your expense. Just make sure that you get that part right. All right? So the volume of a sphere is 4/3 pi r0 cubed. Everything is a constant here. Right? That's just a number. With units, but just a number. All right? And so that rho, in this case, will pull out of the integral. So that's not a hard part. That helps you. So that's rho. And what is the rest? Well, let's see. So we have, the way to think about it is you want to think of having some little differential charge element in general in the midst of this distribution. So we will have a little piece in here. I'll call that little dq. And dq is going to be a distance, a vector r away from point P. And we're going to say that dq is at a position given by a vector r prime. And remember, this is a spherical geometry, so we have to sort of point that in there. Okay? Now, we think of the position of dq usually as sort of given by x, y, and z, but that's not going to be so easy to do here because we have a spherically symmetric charge distribution. So this particular problem screams that you better do this integral using spherical polar coordinates. So
a way to think about that is you can look at the projection of this vector down into the xy plane. And the projection of this vector into the xy plane will be that vector,
which is actually not longer, although I guess I made it look it that way here. And
that particular vector will be at some angle phi relative to the positive x-axis. It will be at some angle. No, that's not the one I want to use. It will be at some angle theta, not phi. Some angle theta down from the positive z-axis.
Okay, so we can describe the position of that differential charge by the three coordinates r, theta, and phi. All right? Theta runs from 0 to pi, and phi runs from 0 to 2 pi all the way around. You seen this? You're okay with that? All right.
So, spherical polar coordinates, really what we want to do. And if we now convert this integral into spherical polar coordinates, what you'll find is that EP is equal to, we now are integrating this piece of charge through this whole distribution. Okay, so that means we need to integrate it from 0 out to R0. We need to integrate it from 0 to 2 pi all the way around. So the first integral, the outer integral, is going to be in R. The next integral is going to be in phi. And then the third integral is in theta, and we want to integrate from 0 to pi. K, rho, which is a constant in this case. And now we have to convert dv into a volume element in spherical polar coordinates. We may talk about that later on, but for right now, what that turns out to be is we're integrating over r prime. So this is r prime squared sine theta. Inner integral is d theta. Next is d phi. Next is dr over r squared. That's the integral you want to do. You good with that? Yeah.
And what is phi used at any point in the equation besides for the d phi?
It is only used as this moves around.
Okay.
So that's the only place it's used. The problem, the rub is here. I cannot just say, well, phi is a constant, so I just say it's 2 pi, or 2 pi. The problem is it depends, the integral, this r cares which phi you're at and which theta you're at. So this r here is changing as you move around in theta and phi.
Okay.
So, if this doesn't scare the crap out of you, then you should probably not be sitting here. Okay. Because that's not nice. That's nasty. All right. So there are different ways of handling nasty in physics. One is you do a computer simulation. That's what engineers do. Okay. One is you give up and say somebody smarter will figure this out someday. The other is you find a workaround. And sometimes that workaround can be quite beautiful. And in this case, what we want to do is to do a workaround. Okay. So that's the next step. So to do a workaround, all right, so really what I'm telling you is there are some geometries where you can analytically calculate the electric field, and you are going to get real good at each of those geometries. I guarantee you. We'll cover all of those in the problem set except for the one we don't cover, which I'll give you on the exam. Or something like that. Okay, so...
smart students will realize that there are a limited number of geometries that I can actually give you, so make sure that you've seen them all. And there are lots of books in the library, so there are ways to figure that out. I mean, just to give you a hint on how to get through graduate school, if you ever decide to go to graduate school, when I was an undergraduate, I went to a very small college that had pretty sorry physics, actually. They had good math and chemistry, so I did all three and was a very poor physicist, so where did I try to go to graduate school? I decided to apply to physics. Okay, that was dumb. But happily, Columbia let me in, and they let me make up lots of undergraduate classes the first year. So it was actually a pretty painful year. And so I had my first exam, and I made 19 out of 100. That was above the mean. '86. Some other grad student who'd had a bit more physics than me actually was also in the class in '86. And me and the grad student, right, and all the undergrads were like, what? The lecture had just nothing to do with the test, right? And the test, so I was pretty bothered by this. I sort of realized there was this complete disconnect between what the professor was talking about and what was on the test. And so I went and dug in the library, and I realized after a little while that the test was actually quite reasonable. It was exactly the test you would give as the first test in quantum mechanics for a junior or something. And so then I realized, okay, so you go to class, you let the professor talk, whatever, but then you have to go and figure this out on your own. So I went and I bought entire library books, basically. I bought just bookcase full of the classic physics textbooks. And I started going through the example problems for that class at that level and making sure I understood them all. And basically, by learning all the classic problems, I found I could do anything he threw at me. So as you get higher and higher, there's only a finite number of actual problems mere mortals can do. So just make sure you know how to do them. They may give you a little twist on them, but it's a little harder when you're down here because I can give you lots of different geometries and I can disguise things in ways and stuff like that. But the higher you get in physics, I mean, when you take quantum field theory, I think I took the quantum field theory whatever in grad school, about quantum field theory 3 or whatever. You know, he let us use a sheet, write anything we want. I simply looked through the books. I realized there were only like three problems he could possibly ever give us. So when I walked in the exam, I had half of the exam already sitting on my sheet. So, and that's a perfectly fair way to prepare. So just remember that. At any rate, So there are specific geometries where you can calculate electric fields. I will give you practice doing most or all of those, and you should just make sure you're very good at that, and then nothing will surprise you. At any rate, there is a way to deal with things that are somewhat more complex, and that's where we're going now. But to get there, we need to talk about something which is called electric flux. So let me start by talking about that. Okay, so flux is, think of it as a sum over stuff that penetrates a surface, okay? So, let's suppose that we have a uniform electric field going from left to right here. And now at right angles to that, I put a square area, which has an area A. Then we would define the flux, the electric flux. We're going to use the symbol phi because it's most easy to confuse with the angle phi that you'll use in spherical symmetric problems. Again, context. So, context. Phi is the symbol we use for flux, and the flux would then be the area times the magnitude of the electric field, which is a constant in this problem. So
it's really, the way to think about it is the amount of electric field that penetrates the surface area per unit area.
It can be complicated because you can have a surface area that is complicated. So you can imagine having some strange surface like this, which might be fully three-dimensional, some weird potato, and you could have an electric field that is truly bizarre. Okay? You could have such a thing. So you can imagine the calculation of the flux could, in principle, be arbitrarily difficult, depending on the geometry. But we're still going to talk about it. And if I asked you to calculate the flux on the lower surface, you would still try to do it the same way. What you would do is at every unit of area, you would calculate how much flux penetrates through that area, and you would put it in a sum. And the sum of that would be the net flux through the surface. So to even talk about that, we have to think about what do we mean when we talk about area and flux on something like this. So this is a curving, strange surface, so we have to define a little unit area that is on that surface at some arbitrary angle. And at that point, you might have a field going through it. So I will usually call this, say, a differential A, so a little dA. Sometimes I might do dA with the A written differently, but don't worry about that. It just means it's Tuesday, and that's how I felt that day. There are other ways to do this that we have to think about. If I take this area up above, and I turn it at some angle, okay, so if I have the field this way and I take it and I just rotate it by some angle, say theta, the flux changes, because now for a field that's headed this way, the window has shrunk. So the amount of field that actually goes through that surface is now smaller by a factor of cosine theta. So I have to have a way of defining mathematically the orientation of this surface in the same way that we have a way of defining mathematically the orientation of the field. And in fact, we do it with a vector. So you should be quite used to this from mechanics, where you have to look in rotation if you ask what is the vector that defines the orientation of a rotating wheel, for example. You use omega. Remember that? You have to have, right? This wheel can rotate this way. It can rotate that way. It can rotate in this plane. It can rotate in that plane. All right, so you use one vector to define how this wheel is oriented, everything. What you do is you say, if it's rotating this way, I grasp the axis like so, and my thumb is pointing, I say, that's the direction of omega. And look, omega is perpendicular to the plane of rotation. So if I want to change the plane of rotation, I just change omega. If it's rotating fast, omega is just bigger. If it rotates the other direction, omega is the other way. So everything gets defined by that one vector, which is at right angles to this wheel. So we're going to do the same thing here. If I define this area by a vector, which I'll call the normal vector, which is at right angles to it, it defines its direction. Okay? You good with that? Okay. So that little dA
I need to have it as a vector because I need to know its orientation relative to the electric field to calculate how much field actually penetrates through this thing. So I can do that by defining this as a normal vector. So my little dA you can think of as a little vector at right angles, like so. Very often, instead of doing it this way, you think of this as something which has a unit area. And you talk about a normal hat, a normal vector, which has n hat. If it's not a unit area, then you would call this n hat dA, and you would let dA tell you how much area is there, but n hat gives you the direction, n hat just being a normal vector. So this and this would be saying the same thing. Okay with that? So, if I have this definition, we can imagine having, look at this geometry up above, I have the E this way, and I have the normal hat vector, say, this way. This is the angle between them, and you'll note that the component of the electric field that penetrates through the surface, that is, the piece of the electric field that goes perpendicular to the surface, because the stuff that's parallel to the surface doesn't penetrate through the surface, right? So the stuff that is perpendicular to the surface is the component of E that is along n hat. And I can project that out by taking the dot product of n hat and E. Right? Because that's what the whole dot product does. You're good with that, right? Work is f dot ds.
So I can define the flux through any surface is equal to the integral over that surface of the electric field dotted into n hat dA. And now I'm integrating over the area of that surface. And this is a very general result.
Okay?
That's not what I wanted to do. I wanted to open that one.
Alright, so I do have one of these little applets to play with this flux to make sure you're getting it. So in this case, here's my little differential surface. There's my n hat vector. The flux is going to be defined as the electric field which is penetrating through that thing.
So let's give the electric field an actual value.
And if you look at it from the perpendicular, I'm sorry, if we look at it along the surface, then we see this, okay? If we look at it from in front, so that the field is coming into our eyes, it looks like this, okay? And now I can vary the angle of the surface a little bit. And you can see, how that will vary the actual flux value if you change it. So as I change that angle, then I'll have less of these flux lines, the field lines that can penetrate through. And
note that I can change the angle all the way around.
Flux lines could penetrate through an area in either direction. So in fact, we do have something which is negative flux. If I define sort of the outside or whatever, I talk about flux that penetrates through one way, it's going to be positive. If it's going through the other way, it's going to be negative.
So you can play with that. Oh boy, that's not what I wanted. Alright, so that's how we define flux, and now if we look at flux for a certain surface, some big three-dimensional surface, and now we have electric field lines that penetrate through this surface in different places. We then have little differential areas with our n-hat vectors on them. And if this is a closed surface, in this case we'll say it's a closed surface. Life is a little complicated because you'll see that if we define n-hat vector for a closed surface as a vector that points out 90 degrees relative to the surface at all points, and that is convention. Okay, a sphere, the n-hat, a positive n-hat vector is always pointing out like the spikes on the sphere. That would mean here, for example, the field is penetrating into the volume. So that's going to be adding negative flux into the sum of the surface over the surface. Here it's penetrating out, and it's going to add positive flux. It's at all different angles, so this dot product is a complicated function of this particular problem. So in this case, the flux, we define it the same way, is the integral over the surface of E dot n hat dA. When we talk about a closed surface, often we will put a circle around the integral because it looks cool. But that, the way to think about that is that means around a closed surface. If I'm doing a curve, I might put that circle and it would mean around the entire curve. Okay, so my context is whether it's a curve or a sphere or something. But we put the circle. So that means it's a surface integral. E dot n hat dA. You might see this written like this. All the same thing. Okay? So the less patient among you might be saying, that's really great, Professor Manley. Why do I give a crap? Here's why. Let's do an example. And let us say that we have a charge Q. And let's say that we have it surrounded by a circle that's not a circle yet, but I will turn it into one, because this thing can do circles better than I can. Okay. All right. And we will say we have, this thing is actually surrounded by a sphere, and the sphere has a radius R0. Maybe that's beginning to seem a little familiar. So we have a point at the origin of a sphere radius R0. What is the flux through the surface? So the flux we've defined, phi is equal to the integral around the surface of E dot dA, if you wish. Okay. Remember, this is the same thing as n hat times dA. By symmetry,
we put this charge at the center of the sphere. So that means the electric field is going to have radial symmetry, and it's going to have every point on the sphere is going to be equidistant from the charge. So the field will have the same magnitude at every point on the sphere. So now there's a lot you can use here. N hat points out radially on this sphere everywhere. The field points out radially everywhere. These are vectors in the same direction, so E dot dA becomes E times dA. Right? It's simple here.
So it's a magnitude thing. E is also constant along the surface of the sphere. So I can pull E out. What is the magnitude of E? E is K Q over R0. And the integral of dA along the surface of a sphere is going to be 4 pi. 4 pi R0 squared. So this just gives me K Q 4 pi. Sorry. K, we often call, it's 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught. You remember on day 1 I told you there's this little mapping that you just sort of have to know. So phi is equal to Q over epsilon naught.
Okay. So in this particular example, what we find is that the flux that goes through this surface, and remember we just chose this R0 out of thin air, the flux that goes through that surface depends only on the charge that's inside. Now, there is particular symmetry in this problem, but it doesn't matter how big this R is because that's not part of the answer. Epsilon naught's a constant.
So that was a pretty problem. We could have things look a little bit tougher. Ooh, not that tough. So we could have some three-dimensional spud, and now we could have a charge here, Q. And if we could ask, what is the flux from this charge Q through the surface, this closed weird potato surface? And this, if we think about the field lines that are come from this Q, might penetrate in and then penetrate out. This one's going to penetrate in, penetrate out.
So where these field lines contribute here, here, and here, they'll contribute with negative signs. Where they contribute here, here, and here, they'll contribute with positive signs. So I think it's not really obvious what's going to happen. You will prove this, I guess, in 217, so I'm just going to tell you what you'll find there. It's not completely trivial proof, I think, so I don't want to do it in here. What you'll find is that the net flux through this surface is zero.
is not at all obvious from looking at it. But it turns out that the field lines penetrating in and the field lines penetrating out, integrating over all the angles, if that surface is a closed surface, you can prove that the net flux through that surface is zero if the charge is outside the surface. So if I have the same surface, or one that's even, you know, another arbitrary surface, and in this case I happen to have a Q1, a Q2, Q3, a Qn, so I have n charges, arbitrary signs, whatever, but I have in principle some net charge inside the surface. Okay? If that's the case, we would say that it turns out that the net flux is equal to the net charge divided by epsilon naught. Which again is not obvious, but you'll prove that in 217. And this is, in fact, what we just found for that particular geometry where it's easy to calculate. So this turns out to be a very general and very important result. In fact, it's going to be one of the core things that characterize electricity altogether. And that is that the flux through a closed surface is equal to the charge that is enclosed within that surface divided by epsilon naught. And this mathematical formula is what we call Gauss's law. Any questions? Yeah.
So I guess not with enclosed surfaces, but does it make a difference whether the object is hollow or building or has an air inside of it?
This law is true whether the object is filled with crud, whether it's a shell, whether it even exists. Because I can make this surface in my mind. I can color it pink. I can make it move. Yeah, in fact, one of the things we're going to do with this is we're going to actually invent surfaces and use this as if there were a surface there. So it doesn't even have to be an object. It's just a little mathematical surface that may correspond to a surface in reality or not. Okay, so this particular thing is true in general. And I hope that we've already talked enough that you realize that it may be true in general, but it may be arbitrarily difficult to calculate in general. Because if I have some arbitrary strange-shaped surface in triangular coordinates, and I have some E that's in some weird thing, I don't know how to calculate that. And even if I do, so what? Unless you ask me what the flux is, I don't know what to do with that. So that's not really why this is generally so useful. But this is always, always true with this force. You have a similar thing for gravity, actually. You can have Gauss's law for gravity, too, if you want to. So this is true in general. All right, so why do you care why you care is that for certain geometries, for certain symmetries, you can calculate this very nicely. So, for example, in the spherical problem that we did, just by inspection, we knew what the magnitude of E was at that surface. We knew that the dot product was just 1, that's E times dA, and the area of a sphere, you can just write down. So that integral was trivial to do. We also could just look at it, and we knew how much charge was inside this. So this law becomes really easy to do when you've got certain symmetries. So that's the power of it. It turns out for things of spherical symmetry, cylindrical symmetry, and planar symmetry, you can do a lot of this very often. And although that may feel very constraining, the truth is you can sort of construct a lot of pretty interesting things out of lines and planes and spheres. So it turns out to be pretty useful. Okay, so let's do one example where we ask for more than something a bit more than what we... In fact, just for completeness, why don't we go back and solve this puppy? Right? All right. So here we go. We're going to take this and we're going to solve for it. In fact, we're going to do more than just solve for it. We are going to find the electric field anywhere in all of space, not just at little point P. All right, so there we are, and let's just sort of simplify this thing. Because I really don't want to look at it this way anymore. All right. So I guess we'll let it still have a radius R0. Okay. And now let's beef the problem up a little bit. We have a spherical distribution. We have constant. If I let my wrist fall down on this thing, sometimes it goes crazy. So we're going to have a constant rho, which is going to be equal to this plus q divided by 4/3 pi r0 cubed if we want. And let us say, what is the electric field everywhere for this problem? Which also includes the point P that we were talking about a minute ago. Okay? Now, if you're one of these people that sometimes has a hard time seeing the forest for the trees, when you see a problem like this, and we say, what is the electric field everywhere? The rest of the universe does not exist. So don't get strung out about that. You have only this thing. Okay, that's all we're worried about. All right. So when I look at this, though, the universe divides up into two distinct pieces. What are they? I'm sorry, I just heard a moment. What? Right. You've got a world inside here and outside. And sort of by generality, you may be closer or farther, but everything really is the same if you're outside in terms of how you might calculate something. So when you look at this, you immediately think, okay, this should break into two pieces. One piece should be for some r which is less than r0,
and another piece for r greater than r0. And for the moment, we'll ignore what happens right on the surface itself. So one might argue three pieces, surface and then in and out. But so we're going to have two worlds there. And what I'd like to do is solve for the electric field in each of these regions separately. So let's start with the region outside. So if I have R greater than R0, what I'd like to do is consider a surface, a spherical surface, which I'll say is at radius r greater than r naught. Okay? What r do I pick? I just pick some arbitrary r that's larger than r0. So it's sort of a general thing. This surface, I just pulled out of my thin air, okay? I made it up. That surface we invent, and we're going to call it a Gaussian surface. And what I'd like to do is to evaluate Gauss's law for that surface. Gauss's law says that the flux is equal to the integral of E dot dA at that surface. And that is equal to Q enclosed over epsilon naught. What is Q enclosed? It's just Q. So the right-hand side is sort of easy to evaluate. So this is equal to Q over epsilon naught for this particular surface. This side is easy to evaluate because of the symmetry of the problem. This is a spherical surface, even though it looks like it has warps. Imagine it's a sphere. And so if I consider it being a surface, the n-hats are all pointing radially outward, which means the electric field, this is a spherically symmetric distribution. The electric field from that distribution has to have radial symmetry because there's nothing to break that. I could make your life miserable. I could make us all miserable if I injected an angular dependence of the charge inside the sphere. Then what I just said is not true. Life becomes really hard. Okay, we're not doing that. This has spherical symmetry, so you can say, by symmetry, the field is radial. In this case, I say it's positive charge, so it's in fact radially outward. So E dot dA becomes E times dA. So this becomes E times dA. I'm integrating over the surface. Again, in this problem, both spheres are centered at the origin. The electric field by symmetry has to be the same in terms of magnitude everywhere on that surface because there's nothing else to break that symmetry. So I know that the magnitude of E is a constant. So this E pulls out of the integral. And now I have an integral over the surface of this sphere, which has a radius little r, which is going to be 4 pi little r squared. So what we find is that E times 4 pi little r squared is equal to Q over epsilon naught, or the magnitude of E is equal to Q over 4 pi epsilon naught r squared. And the direction of E is going to be radial by symmetry. So there is the electric field for r greater than r naught. That is everywhere outside of that sphere. Everywhere outside of the surface of this pink surface, the original sphere, has this electric field. Okay? And note, this is actually just the field of a point charge. Right? If I rename 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught as k, then this is kq over r squared, which you're used to thinking of as a point charge. So, just like you may have seen in mechanics, where you can take a spherically symmetric mass distribution and consider all of its mass to be concentrated at a single point if you're outside the sphere, you can do exactly that in electromagnetism. So this spread out diffuse charge distribution, if you are outside of the charge distribution, it has spherical symmetry, remember that, it looks just like a point charge. Okay? So that is the field outside. How are we going to get the field inside? That's not going to work. Okay. To get the field inside, then we want to consider a Gaussian surface that is inside. So, in that case, we will choose some Gaussian surface at an arbitrary r that is only not arbitrary in the sense that we demand that it be inside of big R. So here we have, again, it's another Gaussian surface, but r is less than big R zero. Okay? And now we go through the same deal. Phi is equal to, this is for r less than r0. So phi is equal to the surface integral, the integral of E dot dA around the surface of that Gaussian surface, which is a sphere. Now this time, life is a little different because we have charge inside this puppy and outside. All right, so it's not quite so obvious. But the spherical symmetry is all still there. E still must be radial. Excuse me. On this surface, E still has to have the same magnitude because there's nothing to break any of those symmetries. Okay? So you should be able to just look at that and say, okay, this flux, whatever it is the charge enclosed. Over epsilon naught. So the flux is equal to Q enclosed. That's not the same Q. Earlier, when we were outside, this piece was easy to calculate because we were outside, so we knew all of the charge was inside. Now, all of the charge is inside. We have some charge outside. Okay. In this case, we have some charge inside this sphere of radius little r, and we have some charge outside. So now calculating this is a bit of a bigger deal. In this case, we have a uniform charge density, so the amount of charge inside should scale with the volume that we've got.
Alright, so we should be able to say that we have, this is going to be the total rho, the charge density, and that should be times the volume inside, which is going to be 4/3 pi little r cubed, that's the volume inside the Gaussian sphere, divided by 4/3 pi big r 0 cubed. No, sorry, we don't need that. We know what rho is. I was sort of writing, but rho is q over 4/3 pi big r 0 cubed. So all we need is the charge density times the volume that's inside. All right, so that's what we've got. If I bother rewriting rho, this is going to be q divided by 4/3 pi r 0 cubed times 4/3 pi r cubed, which is equal to q times r cubed over r 0 cubed. So that would be q enclosed, and I have to do a 1 over epsilon naught everywhere. All right, so that's one side of Gauss's law. The other side is this integral of E dot dA. E dot dA becomes E times dA. The magnitude of E is everywhere the same on this inside sphere, so that pulls out. So the right-hand side, integral of E dot dA, becomes the integral of E times dA, which becomes the magnitude of E times 4 pi little r squared. So now this whole thing becomes E times 4 pi little r squared is equal to q r little r cubed over epsilon naught r 0 cubed. Or the magnitude of E is equal to q r over 4 pi epsilon naught r 0 cubed. And in terms of direction, I know it's radial. So now this one's a little bit different, because what we have, it's a field that depends on where you are inside, depends on r. In fact, its magnitude is growing as you go out in r, which intuitively, maybe if you stop and think about it, it ought to do something, because when you're right in the middle, for every charge you have here and every charge you have here, they sort of cancel each other out. So your field should be zero right in the middle. But it has to grow to what it looks like a point charge when you're out here. As you move off to one side, you'll have more charge over here pointing that way than you'll have charge over here pointing that way. So you might imagine that you'll have some growth as you go out. This proves to you that it's linear. So in the end, if you calculate the magnitude of the electric field as a function of r, where this is r0, what you'll find is that it has linear growth up to r equal r0, and then it falls off as 1 over r squared. And that is the solution to this problem. Okay? Any questions? So here I hope you can see the utility of it. Gauss's law makes life eminently reasonable under the circumstances of symmetry. If you can use Gauss's law, do use Gauss's law. One of the most difficult things that you sort of have to figure out is, for a given problem, when do you brute force try to calculate the electric field using the integral, and when do you use Gauss's law and try to use the symmetry? So you need to get good at identifying those. Anyway, we're done. Have a great weekend. Thank you.